1, 2, 3, 4.
I grew up in a colonial Hong Kong where we were not taught about Chinese culture. When I went back to China, I thought the art in the West is superior to the Chinese, not understanding the Chinese culture. I remember when I first went to China, I tell people I'm a Hong Kongese, I'm not Chinese. It took me 10 years to go back to tell people that I'm Chinese, because then I started to be very proud of the Chinese culture. I think when I went back to Hong Kong at that point, because my ideal job at that time when I was living in UK and studying is to be a perpetual and professional student. I never wanted to return to Hong Kong to become the daughter of my father. So when I saw art and I saw a gallery and I saw all that is a way to get out from my father's control, from my parents' control, because in the art industry, they knew nothing. They have no control. They have no influence. I felt it's all in my own hands. So that is why I chose to do art. But the first exhibition I mounted, during the process, I felt that I'm completely alive again. Every cell of my body, I became so exhilarated. And I knew this is what I should be doing and this is what I want. And I was very lucky because then I really knew about my passion. Before then, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, at that moment, I knew this is what I want to do in my life. I think art is about communication, is about exchanges. I think it's very important that we have different voices that talk about different things. It is the time where art and culture is coming into a big play, because art is about soft power. If we want to resolve misunderstanding, art is the best way to communicate. So use this.
My guest today is Pearl Lam, and if you know the international art market, you know her name. She is a collector turned gallerist who has made it her life's mission to challenge our assumptions about what constitutes contemporary art, especially between Asia and the West. But her journey began in a very personal place, a fierce independence that saw her defying her family to pursue art and immersing herself in Shanghai in the early 90s, where she had to shed her own West is best colonial mindset. She became captivated by abstract art and artists whose work was embedded in ancient philosophies like Taoism and Buddhism, a tradition extending back thousands of years. Now, through Pearl Lam Galleries and her own podcast, she expands her dialogue on creativity, the art market, and the world. She continues to champion her belief in art that transcends borders. We're going to talk about what it takes to have the instinct of a visionary in a constantly changing market, and why she believes the art of real conversation is so critical today. Pearl Lam, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure after I met you last time in Paris.
Yeah, I think it was so nice to see you with one of your artists and then just to get a glimpse, because I know this is happening every day of your life. You, today you said you have a wedding, you probably have even other art events and so many things. This kind of indomitable creative energy that you're really known for, it's just nice to see that a bit in action. So you were sent to boarding school in the US and the UK at the age of 11. I think 10 years later, you were studying fashion and design in London.
No, it was like that. After my boarding school, I was forced to study accounting and financial management. That's my bachelor degree. And then after this, I did a conversion in law. And during that break of the holidays time, I did these short courses of a few months on fashion designing, thinking that I may like to do fashion because one of my father's business is garment manufacturing. And also we have a very casual sportwear brand. And then I realized very shortly, within 2 weeks, I may like to buy fashion, but I'm definitely not a fashion designer. It's better for me to buy, to shop, than to create. So that is why when I returned to Hong Kong, when I was actually demanded to return to Hong Kong to start fulfilling my filial duties, that one of the choice to stay in Hong Kong, to work in Hong Kong, is either to choose to become a lawyer or accountant or charter accountant, which I have flatly turned down.
Well, and it's a very, you know, varied pathway, but I think that these all flow into the gallerist you are today. And I don't want to say gallerist because that's just one aspect of the things that you do. But despite you not wanting to be in fashion, I mean, it's undeniable you have this identity that it is very fashionable.
I love fashion. I love fashion. And I love the people in the creative industry. They are highly motivated. They're hungry and they're talented. They're really interesting people to talk to. Recently, just 3 days ago, I have Jason Wu, the Chinese American designer, who was at my dinner, and she was just sitting beside me. And the stories about how a Chinese being a fashion designer created his career in America is unbelievable. Because it's a tough industry, as tough as in the art industry. I really admire all these personalities.
Yeah, they constantly have to be reinventing themselves. I guess Everyone is artists, but it's kind of the reverse logic. Sometimes with an artist who wants to reinvent themselves, but they're told, you know, keep on doing what we know you for. So is that what drew you to the visual arts then?
I think when I went back to Hong Kong at that point, because my ideal job at that time when I was living in UK and studying is to be a perpetual and professional student. I never wanted to return to Hong Kong to become the daughter of my father. Really, I didn't like it. So when I saw art and I saw a gallery and I saw all that is a way to get out from my father's control, from my parents' control. Because in the art industry, they knew nothing. They have no control. They have no influence. Whether I'm successful or I fail, they're all in my own hands. So that is why I chose to do art. But the first exhibition I mounted, during the process of mounting the exhibition, I felt that I'm completely alive again. Every cell of my body, I became so exhilarated. And I knew this is what I should be doing and this is what I want. And I was very lucky because then I really knew about my passion. Before then, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, and at that moment, I knew this is what I want to do in my life. But at the time, I was just doing as a part-time thing because my agreement with my father was that I wouldn't open a gallery. I could do pop-up shows 3-4 times a year. That was the first pop-up show that I did in 1993.
Yeah, and I think that adaptability serves you well, obviously through your galleries now in Hong Kong and Shanghai, but also the ability to have these ephemeral events. I mean, a lot of us are thinking about what is the future of the art world? What do galleries need to be future-proof, you know, in these uncertain times?
I think the uncertain time, I mean, everybody knows in the art world today, there's a lot of instability. We do not see the end of the tunnel yet. But we also knew that there is a big shift. There is a shift because of technology. There is a generational shift. And I also believe there is a geographical shift. I mean, people have been talking about the technology impact. People have been talking about the Gen Z, the change of pace of Gen Z. But I think this Gen Z change of pace is only limited to Northern America and Western Europe. When you see these Gen Z in Asia, especially in China or in Middle East, they behave very, very differently from the Gen Z, from the Northern America and Western Europe. I feel that the Gen Z of Asia and the Gen Z of the Middle East, they will still continue to collect. And instead of just looking for experiences, as we have been always discussing and talking about it.
Yeah, and I think that people are wanting to go back to experiences, ephemeral things. There's also, you know, mimetic desire, but by which I mean everybody wants what everybody else wants. So they want an individual experience.
Of course.
But they don't know what they want themselves, so they start following a path and think, well, this is what everyone else wants.
I mean, this is not just limited to Gen Z. I think the whole world is like this. We always say that there's 99.9% followers. It's like herd of sheep, right? And then you only have 0.1% being a leader. The leader can be anything, can be a taste leader, can be a political leader, can be whatever. But in general, because I think you want to be accepted by your social group. You want to be like the others. You want to dress like the others. You want to live like the others. You want to have the same art. Well, it's the same philosophy.
But you're the opposite of that. I mean, with your very strong character and you've honed this strong instinct.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. I never wanted to follow anything because being different is also very tough. Because when I was young, when I was growing up, being different is not easy. Being different can sometimes mean that you are being boycotted because you're not like the other people. Unless you are strong enough, not caring about what other people say, just very stubbornly following your own direction. But that also means that you have to have a lot of means and you need to ignore everyone.
So I'm glad that you mentioned of when you were young, because just before I went into this interview, I saw that I guess a former nanny of yours is writing a book, Portrait of Pearl Lam, as a young girl.
Really?
Really? No. No, I'm joking. I just thought that was a roundabout way of asking what were you like as a young girl.
But my nanny passed away. My nanny was my mother's nanny. So that was my heartbreak of a time. She passed away when she was 92.
Oh, wow. What were some of the lessons that you learned, the intergenerational wisdom?
My nanny was the greatest personality who inspired me because I grew up seeing her much more than I saw my parents. She's a tough lady. She always say that, you know, ignore whatever other people say. If you fail, it is right. But who knows whether you're right or not? You're young, right? But she instilled confidence. Confidence is, I think, for any young people, from children to young adulthood, I think confidence is the most important thing. But confidence cannot change to be arrogance. There is a very, very borderline difference, a hairline difference between arrogance and confidence. But I saw my generation of my friends. We grew up, we didn't have so much confidence as today, the younger generation. I think the younger generation, especially in Hong Kong, because of how we grew up in our generation, they have instilled a lot of confidence, love, support, and all that. When we were growing up, I was just comparing this with my friends, and we were just saying that, wow, our parents never told us they love us. I mean, they're Chinese, right? Why would they say that? If they don't criticize you, you're lucky. So not criticizing, that means it's a compliment. I mean, it's very different from my generation of parents. They keep on complimenting their children. They keep on encouraging. We never had that.
Yeah, I think that the love is just there and being there and just nourishing you.
Yeah, exactly. But we never see any problem with this because every one of us, we have parents like that. So it's not a problem. So we don't feel that we are actually different from all or being discriminated or being unloved. No. We know that these are our families. We see no difference about it until we all went abroad. When we saw our foreign friends' parents, especially in America, they are very different from how we grew up. And especially, you know, nowadays, there's so much discussing about mental health, discussing about parental responsibility. See, my friends is constantly in England, turning up to Parents' Day, turning up to all that. We were just saying that when we were in boarding school, we never see our parents there. So I think there's a generation change. I think the younger generation as of today, they are so much more confident than our generation.
Confident, but I may be also confused because we're drowning in data and starved of knowledge.
That is a completely different world. And obviously, they are confronting something that's very different from what we have confronted of. It's a complete different world. It's a technology world. Data, data, data. Also, when you talk about the Gen Z of today, they have short attention span. So when you see this short attention span, then you question, how can conceptual art last? How can we actually, in the next generation, conceptual art can still be prominent when conceptual art requires you to read before you appreciate?
Yeah, and I think that also because they're receiving the art through a screen, of course, there's lots of video artists and people that's their medium. But if it's just about text and there's no physical object, I mean, I think, and I know from different artists that you've celebrated through abstract art, that there is a spiritual dimension that is not one that we experience through the screen. It's one of being in the place with the art. It's a long tradition, as you have talked about the traditional Chinese collectors. It's very erudite. It's one of deep learning. So I don't know how people are experiencing art now, if it's just flashing by. Everything really, anything of value needs time, in my opinion.
I mean, you know how people appreciate art now because there's so many artists upstairs. And you know that people just go in, they browse, they walk away, they browse, they walk away. I mean, very few people has the attention span to listen to what is this artist's intention. I mean, the background of an artist, why is he doing that? I don't think people are actually interested in that. It takes really, you know, when I show a new artist, especially in an art fair, you really have people who really have the confidence. Not knowing the artist, they buy from their heart. They will come in and they will acquire the work and they will try to know of the artist about the work. Most people, all they want is to buy what other people has, and especially brand names. So we have to celebrate a lot of collectors who feels from their heart and they want to learn and they want to acquire something new, not following the trend.
And so is the Pearl Lamb podcast part of introducing these different voices, extending the long form contemplation of art and the biography that goes into art? But we have to say you're interviewing a lot of different people. It's not primarily artists, it's just cultural thinkers and creative practitioners of all kinds.
The beginning of the Pearl Lamb podcast, what I wanted to do is to have a podcast to talk about culture. Culture can embrace all forms, all discipline, all forms. But most important thing is I like disruptors. So I was always looking for disruptors, people who does not follow the mainstream, who disrupt the normal stream, but they have created something. So as time goes by, I meet different people and I evolved and I thought that, you know, you don't just need to interview disruptors. Maybe you should interview people who's interesting, who can inspire other people. It doesn't necessarily need to be a typical art world person. Maybe someone who's very different, who can come out and say very different things. And also, what is our contemporary lifestyle? What is our contemporary culture? So recently, I even invited a numerologist because, I mean, in our world, in our daily life, we look at a lot of our spirituality. So why not I just invite a numerologist? So it's been evolving. And as the art world is, I've always liked to invite different voices. You can be an artist, you can be an art journalist and art critics, or people from outside. I think art is about communication. Is about exchanges. I think it's very important that we have different voices that talks about different things. And it's like recently I've Ben Luke.
And we should say, for those who don't know, that Ben Luke is a critic and broadcaster at the art newspaper.
Yeah, Ben doesn't agree with me that Gen Z is shifting. I think because that he met the Gen Z who are artists, who are from maybe a collector's family. So the background is different. But it's great because you have a different point of view. What we need is a different point of view. Don't you agree?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many different ways of looking at the world. If there was only one way, I mean, what would be the point of living? So I like bringing in all these voices. And yeah, we always make these generalizations because, you know, also I work a lot with students in universities.
That's great. These are the young mind. Young mind, they have a lot of ideals. You know, I think every student, they have so much ideals. During the time when they are in university is the time where they fight for their ideals. And these are the most impressive because they're not diluted by all their desire. Money, a great career, blah, blah, blah. But it's ideals. Those are most precious time.
And ideas, we talked a little bit about your instinct, but I'd like to go a little bit more into it because you just when you're selecting an artist or you're telling the story, sometimes an artist is not the best teller of their own story. Sometimes they're so caught up in it and you're becoming their storyteller. I think that you're born with it, but how did you form your intuitive intelligence?
I don't know. You know, I always advise people when they collect an artist, they have to do research and everything. I never did it. I never do any research. When I see a piece of work, I looked at it, I'm connected with it, then I start. I usually, if I go to art fair, I will buy the work first before I will even study the artist. Sometimes I go to, like last year when I was in South Africa, I went to 80-something artists looking around to have an artist that connected with me. So I did find one or two artists there. which I think is really interesting. Because after I saw the artwork, then I start to ask questions. I start to study them. I start to get my curator to send me essays and everything about them. So then I start to get to know them. Then the second meeting will be talking to them, finding more about them. So that's how I connect with the artists. Like there's one Nigerian artist now, Alimi, we're representing him globally. I went to his place, I went to his house, I went to his studio. I went to the gallery. I love his work. That was in Lagos. So I started going to the house. I started going to his studio and talking to him. And I find we click. And I like the way he approached art. So therefore, we are working together to create a career path for him internationally. He's known in Lagos, but he's not known internationally. So my job is find opportunity and to create a different path for him, to make him internationally known.
And developing relationships then also with museums?
Developing relationships, also inviting different curators to talk to him, to create a show for him. Like now we are talking to one curator who will be creating a show in Shanghai next March for him. So I'm just creating this international recognition relationship for the artist. I think that is very important, especially if they are in a place that they are quite secluded, because Lagos is not a really international place that people would go all the time.
And I was really surprised, because I don't know so much about the contemporary collecting market in China, but you've said, but this doesn't surprise me knowing what I know from our different Chinese colleagues, is that they're very curious internationally, that previously the collecting was by Chinese, different countries, you know, support their own. But in the contemporary market you identify in China, they're very international, very curious. What do you put that down to?
Actually, I think there is a problem with the younger generation collecting art. They all study from America abroad. Now, they only mainly is collecting international artists. This is really a phenomenon, because if you look at every country, you have Taiwan people only solely first collecting Taiwan artists, or Africa, you start collecting African artists. You know, every country, the priority is collecting their own country artists first. In China, if you look at the auction market, now 70% is international artists. So the contemporary artists where they collect of the Chinese is very, very minute, very small the market. And because, as I said, most collectors, especially when they are abroad studying, they want to be at par with the international collectors. If America is collecting American African artists, you will find Chinese collecting American African artists. Whatever artists make the name, especially in the auction market, huge, they will be collecting that. And especially whatever America, you know, hot artists, they're all collecting that. I don't want to say whether this is right or wrong. I think this is a phenomenon, because it never happened in any other countries except in China. I honestly think it's a bit sad, because for younger artists, without a group of younger collectors supporting them, it's very tough. Especially now, it's a tough art market. You have younger Chinese artists which have more international collectors collecting them than their old Chinese counterpart.
I guess I don't want to say novelty, but it's mysterious.
No, it is a novelty. No, because when you can understand that, because let's say that you're educated in America and UK, you see how people live, you see how people collect, you just follow them. And they became the example, the ideal collection is them. So you follow them. I mean, for me, the same thing. When I went back to China, I thought the art in the West is superior to the Chinese, not understanding the Chinese culture. I remember when I first went to China, I tell people I'm a Hong Kongese, I'm not Chinese. It took me 10 years to go back to tell people that I'm Chinese, because then I start to be very proud of the Chinese culture. Then I realized that even the new conceptualism, like words becoming artworks, I mean, it only started in the 60s in America. In China, it's 1,000 years ago, right? Without an artist pinpointing me to look at that, I completely missed it because I thought that in my education, I mean, I'm trained in my eyes, everything. I thought the Western culture is superior over the Chinese until gradually I was pinpointed by different artists, by different curators to let me to see different things. I knew zero about Chinese culture. So I can understand, but the only thing that I was a little bit lost about this phenomenon is these kids grew up in China. I grew up in a colonial. I grew up in Hong Kong, where we were not taught about Chinese culture. But these kids is from a very Chinese traditional family, from a Chinese school, even if they study in an international school in China, but their Chinese culture is not like us. So I was a little bit lost about it. Hopefully, when they become more confident, they come back, they will find themselves, like what I did.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's even another way of thinking about it, because like you having this really strong spirit and confidence, maybe it's the fact that, you know, they have a long sense of history and just knowing Chinese history, that it will always be there. They have a really strong sense. And so why not just explore some of these other areas, because their curiosity, like yours, is insatiable. But they know their own country, and so they don't have to be limited by that.
I'm not saying that they should be limited. Mm-hmm. I am saying that, yes, Bohard, it's great that you're collecting international artists, but please look at some Chinese artists. All right, you have to look at the Chinese, you look at the international, and then you understand this cross-cultural dialogue. Because just having a collection, just having international artists living in China is meaningless if you don't root yourself in your own culture. That's what I'm saying. I mean, your stop in collecting international art is great, because that's what we go abroad, we learn, we absorb, and we want to bring it back to our country. But I think it's really important also to support the Chinese art scene. And also it's more interesting if you create a collection where there's a dialogue between China and the international countries.
So it does bear to ask what you have on your own walls. I mean, I know you're always changing the walls of your galleries, but what are the dialogues that are happening in your own walls, your personal?
I mean, in my own collection, I have, of course, I will be mainly in an abstract, right? So, of course, I have Chinese abstract. I have UK artists. I have Austrian artists, German artists, and I have African artists as well. So it's just like a cross dialogue and all the time.
Yeah. And going back to the core, because that's really where you establish, I think, if I know the chronology right, you released the abstract art.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I was interested to note that you said that you meditate and chant every day.
Today I didn't. I have to dash it to the cathedral, so I didn't. But usually, yes, every day I do. It calms me down.
I think also helps reconnect with the natural world and our inner life.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
I met a Rinpoche, a living Buddha, in 2008. And then I converted. I became a Buddhist, but I still go to church because I went to a French conference school. I like the philosophy about Buddhism. And the main thing is they ask you to find yourself and to be yourself. And I think that has always been what I practice, to find myself, to be myself. I never realized that it was a Buddhism philosophy. So from then, I start reading about Eastern spirituality. I start talking to a lot of these spiritual people. And also what is amazing is when I speak to the Chinese abstract artists, they all talk about Taoism. They all talk about Buddhism and how they practice in their artwork. Yeah. So that becomes more prominent. That also inspired me to research more.
And you also studied, it wasn't your main study, but you paint watercolors in your youth. You learned the old techniques.
Yeah, because I was forced. When I was young, there's nothing called ADHD, right? So I was jumping up and jumping down. And my father forced me when I was age 4 to do calligraphy so that I would sit down, learn how to be focusing, learn to be patient and all that. And I hated calligraphy. Intensely. So from calligraphy, I was forced to do Chinese ink brush painting. So I was doing that until I was 11. Then when I was in UK doing my A-levels, I was lazy. So I thought I could do art. Because then when I was doing art, I was implementing my Chinese ink brush techniques into watercolors. So I did start painting in watercolors to pass exams, not just because I'm interested in it. But I have to say, when I start painting, it also calms me down and also makes me focus.
And I think that it must really help you have, you know how you say you have this immediate response, just being so familiar with the immediacy of the mark and the personal expression through that, the energy that's captured in calligraphy. I think it just must help you have that connection with artists and what they're saying.
I think calligraphy is expression, you know? You really have to feel for it to do it. But my calligraphy is really bad. And I was always asked, I cannot do those big calligraphy with the free fall. I was always punished to do those little small words. You have to craft everything in the strokes. When do you put pressure? When do you lift up? And so that the lines are from thick to thin. Since I was young, I was asked to do that. So I have a huge resentment until I was older. Then when I started looking at Chinese art again, I went and looked at calligraphy. And then from calligraphy, then, of course, I looked at the Chinese abstract. It was like an evolution. I like Chao Shu, the really, really, you know, the very free-form script.
Yeah, there's so much, and it's a dying art form, really. Now, I'm not saying in China, but in general, we've almost forgotten how to use our own personal handwriting, which I find it gives you such a connection.
My personal handwriting is so ugly. The other day, I was just trying to write some names on a name card. My God, the handwriting is so awful. I think we stopped writing, right? We stopped writing. We don't have the practice anymore.
Well, almost. And also we began this discussion talking about AI, and I don't believe in using it. I want to express myself in my own words, not somebody else's words. I don't understand where it's coming from, but people are using it for that. Actually, when I was writing down questions for you, this is funny, because you have a strong voice and I could hear you in my mind's eye thinking, oh, don't ask her that. Don't. And I thought, what would a Pearl Lam chatbot be like? I was wondering.
Oh, you should do the AI. I want to see what I say. Because ChatGPT sometimes gives some wrong information.
But I was wondering, what if you were to invent a Pearl Lam chatbot?
Oh, it would be quite funny.
Yes. I was curious what ingredients would go into if a chatbot was created. Like, start your morning. Well, you've got to do this. Well, you begin with your meditation. Chat. Now go out. You're going to travel here tomorrow. This is what you need. I imagine it would be a great motivator.
Oh, no. My motivation every morning is I have different alarm. You know, I was saying to myself, you know, when I was in boarding school, I hate these alarm. Ring, get up. Ring, brush your teeth. Ring, ring. And now I'm setting the alarm for myself to govern myself each moment, what I'm doing. So the things that I have resented when I was young, I'm putting this to myself now. So it's really weird.
You know, it's interesting you say that. It doesn't surprise me because you fill your life. And I'm wondering, you have all these timers that you set, but at the same time, there's such an air of freedom meeting you. I feel like, you know, you're very spontaneous. So I don't know how those two coexist.
I mean, yeah, exactly, because I'm always late. That's my problem. I'm always late. So I always overrun things. So I always set the alarm, trying to be not early. I try to be punctual. So today I was so worried that I'll be later than the bride arriving at the church. So I time myself really, really early to arrive at the cathedral. I arrived only 5 minutes before because I found it body traffic jam. My alarm is to schedule me so that I will be punctual, but I still do not meet my target.
Yes. What do you think instilled that sense of urgency in taking in all that the world has to offer?
Because I always do too much every day. You know, if I do 3 things less, then I'll be punctual. But no, I want to squeeze everything in. I always say to myself, if I'm alive, I want to live fully every single moment in my life. So I have to utilize it. So I never have enough sleep.
Oh, And you talked a little bit about your nanny and people who have been important in honing your vision and who you are today. And what do you think some of those important lessons are that they passed on to you that maybe you pass on to others?
Never be fearful about failures. Failures are good, especially when it happens at a young age. But failures means that you have to learn from it, not to commit the same mistake all the time. So I always say that, and also take a positive. Always be positive. Take a positive view on everything you do. Even if you are at the wrong, learn from it.
And this is just in closing, as you think about the future, the kind of world we're leaving, the next generation, the importance of the arts, with all our imbalance and the ecological crisis and all these things that we face coming down the line, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
Today, the world is very divided, lots of fractures. And it is the time where art and culture is coming into a big play, because art is about soft power. If we want to resolve misunderstanding, art is the best way to communicate. So use this.
Yeah. And you're a great communicator with soft and world power. So thank you, Pearl Lam, for sharing with us your fearless vision, boundless curiosity, and empathic imagination, and your commitment to art that crosses borders, bridges cultures, and helps us understand what it means to be human. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The creative process is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. The creative process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support was by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.